The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, joining you on this fine Wednesday morning from the Far East. That is the Far East of Germany and Berlin. My name is Daniel Frieber. I'm the host of today's episode of the Cycling Podcast as we take a closer look at the first newly unwrapped present on the professional cycling's off-season Christmas tree. That is the route of the 2023 Giro d'Italia. A mere 199 days until the 2023 Giro. What a daunting prospect. Joining me today from the Costa Blanca, it is a veteran of 5 Giri d'Italia as a rider. We think 15 as a direct sportif. Very important for the purposes of today's podcast. He's a Tour de Suisse stage winner, a Tour Down Under stage winner. He made history at the 2004 Tour de France by breaking a collarbone on the first climb of the race. That climb being a slightly raised television cable, which he toppled over on the way to the start line. Over the last decade, he has masterminded Grand Tour and Classics victories from the front seat of a team car, while also racking up more unpaid appearances on the Cycling Podcast than Remco Evenepoel has had DMs from RCS Sport-affiliated social media accounts in the last month. It is the Bike Exchange. Jayco, Head Sports Director, Matt White. Matt, how are you?
Good. Yeah, very good. Very good. Enjoying the first week of the off-season.
Matt, I mentioned those appearances on our podcast, but I've also been listening to you on a couple of other podcasts. I know you like to play the field. You know, some slightly more controversial podcast than ours, you know. But, you know, that's fine. If that's what you need to that's what you need to make you feel edgy, then that's fine.
Mate, I'm open doors. Open doors.
You're big flirt.
Don't knock it till you try it. Don't knock it till you try it.
It's a broad church, Matt. You're right. You're welcome here. Also joining me today from Soya in Mallorca, it is the long-serving Eurosport cycling commentator, multilingual voice of cycling, and erstwhile Accrington Cricket Club pie thrower, a man whose accents can take you around the world in 10 seconds of broadcasting, but whose palate has only just discovered avocados and is still unsure whether hummus is too exotic for him. It is my former flatmate and whipping boy in the annual Sacalobra mountain time trial. It is Rob Hatch.
Good morning.
You did beat me once in the Sacalobra time trial.
I was going to say, never mind.
Yeah,
never
that
mind.
Was many moons.
A few kilos ago, that.
A few kilos ago. Chaps, a little bit of a roundup now on what's been happening in the world of professional cycling. Feel free to interject. I will be, asking you for your views, observations on a few of these issues anyway. Feel free to pass as well. A few thorny issues in there. The racing season officially, definitively closed for many World Tour and Pro Conti teams this week when with a couple of races in the Far East. You'll remember hearing that some of the leading teams had added the Tour of Langkawi to their calendar in the scramble for UCI points to stave off relegation. That decision was justified for Movistar, with Ivan Sosa winning overall in Langkawi. Although the Spanish team had by then already amassed enough points to secure their top division status for next year. Similar story at the Japan Cup, where EF Education First Easy Post finished first and second, well, with Nelson Paulus and Andrea Piccoli. That team too had been threatened by relegation earlier in the year. Those results mean that Israel Premier Tech and Lotto Soudal now face the chop and will lose their World Tour status in 2023. A reminder, though, that Lotto do at least qualify for the major tours on the basis of their 2022 ranking as the Total Energy. Israel, on the other hand, will only receive automatic invitations to the one-day World Tour races. YT, I mentioned that scramble for points. It is over. You guys, as were, you know, almost half the World Tour was sort of dragged into that battle at one point. Bit of a relief that it's all over?
Definitely a relief. So the status for the 18 teams who qualified, now they have to go through the process of ticking two other boxes with the UCI, which is one behind the closed doors, is that we have our license once we tick those two boxes for the next 3 years. So it is a big relief. So teams like Lotto Soudal, Israel, and teams who want to come up over the next 3 years can do so, but if they are the best ranked team outside of that 18. So they're fighting every year for 3 years. But for us, you know, it was looking back at now, this was a 3 year process that was run, you know, 3 years ago. I think where the where the World Tour was is, you know, we were losing a team every second year and really scrambling as an organization to keep World Tour sponsors in the sport. And for this year, having 20 teams putting their hand up to join the World Tour is, for me, is a really positive thing. And I just see how it played out over the last couple of years. No team in 2019 was looking at three years of points and how they best allocate 3 years of points. To be honest, we didn't look at it until the end of last year because, you know, that 3 years was run through a pandemic. The calendar was totally different to what it was planned on lots of different fronts. And we did enough this year to make sure. I think I added 40 plus race days this year to the calendar. We're traditionally a team that does not do excessive race days because of the way our sponsors have let us race, and two, the fact that because we are our primary sponsor is an Australian, we haven't got the same ties to races in France or Belgium or Italy or Spain. So those teams who have sponsors located in those regions obviously are committed to do every race in those regions. So I did add a lot of race days just to make sure. And then also, like all teams, we had our fair share of bad luck. Our number one rider, Simon Yates, out of those 3 years, only finished one Grand Tour. You know, at the 2020 Giro and the 2022 World Tour, he was taken out by COVID. So two times in the last 3 years. And last year he finished third in the and we lost the Giro this year with injury, and last year he finished third in the Giro. So we've had our fair share of ups and downs, but we always knew that we were good enough to arrive inside the 18, even though I'm not a big fan of the way the points are allocated.
Yeah, I think we spoke yesterday, didn't we, Matt, about the Japan Cup, which I mentioned there. Nielsen Paulus won that. I mean, you said as many points as a Grand Tour stage win. Is that right, or more?
It was worth the same as two stage wins in the Giro or two stage wins in the Vuelta. You know, and that was a race, for an example. That's a race that we had been to for the last 7 or 8 years, but were declined entry into this year because due to the fact that the Japan Cup hasn't got a relationship with our major sponsor, Giant. So it's a point score system. Or for example, Israel couldn't go to Malaysia due to religious grounds. They were rejected. So it's a point score system. We're trying to compete against each other, but we actually can't even enter the same events. So
I think it's like a Premier League football season in which the teams don't play the same number of games and they're playing against different teams.
Yeah. Or you can go duck off a team in the La Liga, can duck off and get some points in Luxembourg for the weekend.
I think looking at it from the outside, gents, I think the idea of promotion and relegation is something that's positive for the sport, just because it gives those newer teams an opportunity, like, you know, you've just been talking about football, to get a chance to compete against the best, to work their way up on merit and what have you. And those who aren't performing, I know it's not nice, is it, for those who are involved and the worries about jobs and things like that, but, you know, the ones who aren't performing get relegated. However, like you say, the point system does seem to be crazy. And one other thing I'd add into it as well is that it's impossible for fans to understand it. Fans don't know how many points are available for this win, that win, what have you. It could
fans
be simplified.
And
journalists. Well, commentators as well, yeah. I mean, it's...
And some teams, by the looks of it.
Well, and it's interesting, actually. You said that, you know, you weren't really looking at it until the end of last year. Where we were sitting as well, we look at every race we talk about. I know it might not seem it sometimes, but, you know, we sit down and have a look what the panorama is, and it's not something we were looking at until sort of getting to on this spring either, or even bringing into our narrative. So I think the whole maybe three-year plan thing needs looking at again. And like everything, it's not perfect, but I would say that from where I'm sitting, the most important thing is that points have to be a lot easier for everybody to understand. Otherwise, if we've got a story, how can you not follow it or tell it? It's a bit of a strange thing.
No, definitely. No, I'm the same. I think a relegation system, that's only a positive if we've got teams who have the capacity to move up, but there has to be a fair system where we can compete on the same level for those points as well.
Chaps, some more racing news from Italy. We had the Giro del Veneto last Thursday, I think it was, in the Colli Imberici above Vicenza. Rob Hatch commentated. I think he can tell us who won that.
Can I remember who won that? Every race blends into another at this stage of the season. I'm going to cheat and look right back through the results.
It was Matteo Trentin.
Thank you. Matteo, at least you were watching.
This was, I think you commentated on this as well, so you should at least remember. This was only a couple of days ago. You should remember this one. This was followed by the Serenissima gravel race, also in the Veneto, won by Swiss rider Rob.
I didn't commentate on that one. No, that's one of the new races that doesn't get coverage. We did the World Championships, which is an experience in itself, trying to follow that. But the Serenissima Gravel, unfortunately, didn't have any tele coverage. No.
That was won by Robin Froidevaux, a name that I'm not very familiar with.
He's Swiss champion on the road.
Team. Is he Swiss champion on the road?
He is, yep.
After that came the Veneto Classic on Sunday, where the winner was Mark Hirschi. In 30th place in that race was Davide Rebellin. And yes, it was Rebellin's last ever race as a professional cyclist, barring any kind of rethink. He'd finished 5th in the same race in 1992, beating the likes of Laurent Fignon. He's 51 years old. He's older than Jens Vogt, Lance Armstrong, and yes, 3 years older than Matt White. Matt, how would you feel sitting here today contemplating the last 3 years of your professional career as a rider? Because you're 48, if I'm not mistaken.
I am 48, and I cannot fathom it. I did race more. Well, my whole career was the same period as a part of David Rebellin's career. And I do remember him very well from the 90s and the 2000s. And for him to still be going at a pretty competitive level is hard to explain. It's hard to explain. But, if he sticks to these guns, that'll be the last time we see him with a number on in a UCI race. You never know. He might move on to Grand Fondos. I'm pretty sure he's not going to be able to put away the bike that easily. So I dare say he'll still be racing, but maybe not with the same team or on the same type of racing.
Another retirement over the weekend at a much more reasonable age. Former hour record holder Alex Dowsett. He concluded his career at the Chrono des Nations, which was won by Stefan Kung. Track cycling, not my speciality. It was the World Championships last week. I saw and understood enough to know that Filippo Ganna broke the men's world individual pursuit record, take gold in that event. Speaking of riders who will also be familiar from the road, Ethan Hayter won the men's Omnium. Benjamin Thomas and Donovan Grandin won the men's Madison. Elia Viviani won the elimination. And the Great British Quartet of Bigham, Hayter, Vernon and Wood won the team pursuit. In the women's team pursuit, an Italian foursome made up of Balsamo, Consoni, Fidanza and Guazzini won gold. Fidanza also won the scratch race. Francisca Brauser won the individual pursuit. Lotta Capecchi won the elimination. And also the Madison with Sari Bosut, I think is how you pronounce her name. Nia Evans won the women's points race and Jennifer Valente won the Omnium. In Belgium, Remco Evenepoel became the youngest ever winner of the Flandrian of the Year award. Rob, is that just the best Belgian rider, isn't it? It's not the best rider outright.
Yes. He also won the Cristallen Fiets as well, which is the sort of... But it's another cycling awards for the
Emmys.
Yes. It's the rival awards. I think that's to be honest, I'd put that on a slightly higher in terms of media attention. That's the one they all want to win, the Cristallen Fiets. That was about a week before, I think.
Next, some transfer news that is confirmed news and also a bit of gossip as well. Transfers, we mentioned last week that Ineos Grenadiers had a big announcement coming. Well, it duly dropped on Wednesday, and as predicted, it was the signing of that organisation's first ever female rider, the multidisciplinary world champion, including gravel, incidentally, Pauline Ferrand-Prévot, not Primoz Roglic, as we speculated about a couple of weeks ago. Talking of announcements, we expect the team formerly known as B&B Hotels to unveil Mark Cavendish as their new talisman at a press conference before the Tour de France route presentation later or next week. We think the team will also announce the signing of Max Richese as Cavendish's lead out man and of BMC as their new bike supplier. None of that is yet confirmed, I should stress. Talking of sprinters, the record-breaking 40-time Giro d'Italia stage winner Mario Cipollini has been given a 3-year prison sentence for violent and threatening behaviour towards his ex-wife Sabrina Landucci. Charges were brought after an altercation at the fitness studio where Landucci worked in 2017. Cipollini's lawyers have announced they will appeal the decision. And finally, something much less grave, much less serious, but worth mentioning. Another rumour at this stage regards equipment changes. It's been reported, rumoured at this stage, that Jumbo-Visma will be swapping Shimano group sets for SRAM in 2023. And UAE will go from Campagnolo to Shimano. Now, Matt, I'm not going to ask you to wade into the culture war of Campagnolo versus Shimano versus SRAM, but... And this is something you'll be familiar with, the issue of equipment changes. I mean, you guys, from what I gathered, not only from you, but a number of your riders last year, you had a positive equipment change, something you were very happy with, and that was the frame supplier. You started using Giant bikes last year. But, you know, we've also seen examples in the last few years. There was the Movistar, well, the Movistar documentary told, El Día Menos Pensado told us about how difficult that team had found. That was a move from Campagnolo to SRAM. The complications that that brought for the mechanics, and it led to incidents in races. Again, not because of the inherent quality of the components, but simply because the mechanics weren't used to working with certain equipment. So just talk to us a little bit about how much of a risk it is to change, well, something as fundamental as a group set.
Our organization's been lucky enough to stay with Shimano for 11 years, but those rumors that you mentioned there, that's a big one, especially with Jumbo, because you know we have seen SRAM go up and down in waves. At one stage there, probably 6 or 7 years ago, I reckon they probably had nearly half the world tour. Pretty close to, like maybe 7 or 8 teams. Mm. And then I don't actually know who's riding SRAM at the moment, but there's not too many teams. So to have a team of that quality, and obviously with the Tour de France winner riding SRAM next year, once it is confirmed, that's a big move for SRAM. And also Jumbo have been a very big promoter and leading the way for Shimano for a long, long time.
It's a Japanese company, but they've always kind of been based, the European kind of nerve center has been in the Netherlands, hasn't it?
Correct. So that's a big one. That is a really big one. But as far as risks, I think all the componentry, SRAM, Campag and Shimano, it's all good quality. That's for sure. The bits and bobs that go with it, when you're with those companies, that is not just components. That also usually brings wheels, sometimes tires, seats, handlebars, you name it. So it can be a big change, and I think that's where sometimes that is also difficult for the riders sometimes as well. You know, if you're changing everything to the one season, there's not naturally some hiccups and some teething pains in the early months of that change.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Some big news from Super Sapiens this week, because if you use a Wahoo bike computer, specifically the Bolt V2 or the Roam V2, you can use Bluetooth to stream real-time glucose levels direct from your Abbott Libre Glucose Sport Biosensor to your handlebars. And that's a real game changer, because it means you don't need to use your phone when you're cycling, and it means that you can monitor glucose levels while riding. And some of Super Sapiens' ambassadors have already talked about how much of a game changer this is. Lauren De Crescenzo said, "The live readings on my Bolt 2 allow me to keep my glucose stable and avoid major drops, which would usually result in a loss of power on the bike. These live glucose readings played a significant role in defending my title at SBT Gravel." And Rachel Nayland said, "Often we don't realise how much fuel it takes to maintain optimal glucose levels and how it can rise and fall during sessions depending on the type of nutrition used. It's a brilliant new tool and another way to expand my high performance kit." Well, if you want to find out more about Super Sapiens and its compatibility with Wahoo, or just check out how it all works, go to supersapiens.com.
Well, a sound synonymous for many of our listeners with the Giro d'Italia. That was our Giro d'Italia theme music, provided by Amaraterra, Cozze. You'll be hearing that again in May. Also taking me to Italy on this fairly dingy October morning is Rob Hatch's attire today. He's wonderful. He's wearing a wonderful throwback Roberto Baggio Italian national jersey.
Let's hope I don't miss the penalty, eh?
This reminds me of an interview I did with Chris Froome on the Giro a couple of years ago, 3 or 4 years ago. We were surrounded by signed shirts of the legends of Italian football, including Roberto Baggio. And I tried to quiz him, or this was my opening gambit, something about Roberto Baggio. He'd never heard of Roberto Baggio, Chris Froome. Shameful, shameful. And we are shocking. Now going to talk about the Giro d'Italia 2023, talking about things that immediately remind me of the Giro d'Italia, make me think of the Giro d'Italia. Matt, why I mentioned that you've done, well, you did 5 as a rider, 15 as a DS, and now there's some point every year, usually in the spring, where I see you at a race and I sort of ask you what you've got coming up next, and there's always one point in the spring when you're heading over to Italy to do some kind of recon road trip, and these road trips in my mind have assumed this kind of mythical aura, sort of National Lampoon's Vacation kind of, and that's the image I have of them in my head, or something, you know, Jack Kerouac. I don't know what you get up to over there, but tell us, in fact, tell us what particularly in this age of so much information, we talk a lot about VeloViewer and all the resources available nowadays. Why do you still need to go and get boots on the ground and look at the route well ahead of time?
Well, where the process starts for, it has in the last 15 years for me, is when I first started as a director, there was no VeloViewer. So, you know, there was maps. And maps don't give you that good a picture of what's coming up. So I would always go, well, the vast majority of those last 15 years I've been at Tirreno. So I'm already there in Italy. So what I would do is I would go either pre-Tirreno, that gap between Tirreno and Milan-San Remo, or even stay on even longer. And that was a really good window where I was in the middle of Italy. But I could either go, I would usually go south because, one, they're the stages that are less familiar in general with most people. Especially Sicily and the deep south. We don't have bike races down there like we used to in the 80s or 90s. There used to be lots of regional tours down there that we don't have anymore. And it all depends on what the focus is. So before, when I was looking, when we had a sprinter, for example, and you're going to the Giro with the sprinter, it would be, you're looking at a stage, looking at profiles, GPX files recently and going, well, that could be a sprint, but it would really give me a better idea of those stages, seeing them visually myself. And I could leave those stages going, well, actually, that stage is too hard for our sprinter. We are not going to commit on this day to bring it back. Or the other one is, well, actually, this climb is in a forest. If the wind's doing this, if the brakes are a small one, actually, we have got enough time to bring this brake back. So merely managing the resources for a sprinter. And then the Giro, the sprint stages, we'd always try to do last minute recon because the run-ins and those sort of the details would be different to what you would see in March or April to actually what it would look like barricaded. And then the last 5 to 6 years or even longer, when I've gone with the GC focus, I'd be looking at other things. Now, what I'd be looking at, we would not look for sprint stages at all. We would be looking probably more at the intermediate stages in the Giro. Because they're not the stages where you win the Giro or lose the Giro, but you can certainly save a lot of energy. So, you know, the Queen stages, the stages usually in the Dolomites, we found out the Giro route this week. No, I don't envisage anyone of the GC caliber of the Giro going into the mountains next week to have a look at them, because within a couple of weeks I'll be closed with snow. And a lot of those ones, we'll leave those to the very end, like as close to the start of the Giro as possible, if we even recon them. But those stages in the south especially, or those intermediate stages where you've got 3 to 3,500 meters of climbing, they're the stages that I would really take a real keen look at. And it would really help me when I was designing a plan 2 months later of how we approach those stages. So I really enjoyed it. I really do love Italy, and we would also divvy those up. Now I've got 6 or 7 sports directors, and you know, back in 2008 we had 3. So we also divvy those up as well within the sports director group. So I would do a group in the south. Another director would do some in maybe the northeast, and we so you know, the last couple of years we would basically cover every stage that wasn't a sprint stage before we got to the Giro. So we would have a very good picture of what our race looked like well in advance.
I mean, and even that, Matt, I think I'm right in saying it doesn't insure you completely against the odd unpleasant surprise. I remember a stage a couple of years ago in Agrigento, I think it was, early in the Giro, where I think I spoke to you after the finish, and you were horrified to find out that the last 2 kilometres were nothing like what I think they were different from what the roadbook said. They were certainly different from what you expected them to be.
No, that has happened a couple of times where you would spend 6 hours in a car, 7 hours in a car driving a route there, and you get to the final, you make all your notes, pop it in here and pop it in there, and then you get back and they've adjusted the course to take a different pass. Or everything's the same until 5 kilometres to go, and instead of a straightforward run into the final, you have this technical running that you've never seen before. Things like that. The other one is road quality. Knowing how Italians do things, and also the locals get excited when the Giro comes because they know they're getting new roads. But when those roads are laid, one year I checked out a major time trial in the race in March, and I was out in the course, and the roads were terrible, absolutely terrible. There's a section, and it was one part of it was on a descent, and it was quite concerning the surface of this road. And we went through March, April. It was a time trial after a rest day, and I was like an hour and a bit, maybe hour and a half drive away from this course. And I thought, after lunch, I've got nothing else to do. I'll go out and rip around the course again. And so in the car I went, got there, it was maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon, came around the corner, and there were these massive, all these trucks laying new road at 3 p.m. the day before the TT. So all the notes that I'd made about this time trial, how it was technical here, bad road surface here, stay on the left, stay on the right, the next day it was brand new road surface, still drying. So there's a lot to see, but you know, I'm used to it. But it was an annual trip I would do in March. If I had to make another nip back just before the Giro started in April, I would do so. But for me, it was very important. And I've done it with a few different people. It's easy to do with someone else because, you know, someone driving, someone, you can do the stages a lot quicker if you haven't got to stop all the time and make notes, or even if it is audio notes, or it's easy to do with someone else. And I do love Italian food and food and beverages. So it was never a dull trip.
Well, chaps, I said it was the official presentation just a couple of days ago. We'll have our own presentation now, and the master of ceremonies will be Robert Hatch. Rob, take us up to stage 10. Tell us what we've got.
Pressure's on here. Use full name. It's like my mum talking to me. Here we go. Right then. So another Giro d'Italia, 106th Giro d'Italia, 2023 edition. And Abruzzo, where it starts, to Rome, where it finishes. Doesn't sound like too much of a trek, does it? But it's Italy, and we're taking the scenic route, as always, starting with a time trial along an old bike path on the Adriatic coast. It sort of reminds you a little bit of San Remo. Good memories there for Whitey a few years ago on the team time trial. This is a bit longer, though. This is 18 kilometres long, individual time trial, and an uphill finish to Ortona means that the GC riders won't really be able to ease their way in too much before the sprinters get their first chance when the race heads south the day after. The Giro will then pass through Melfi before going into Basilicata, Lago Lasceno, scene of wins for Alex Zula, and more recently Domenico Pozzovivo in 2012. So 11 years later we're going back there. The race then goes west to Campania and returns to Salerno. The following day, stage 6 promises to be the most spectacular of tourist adverts. Napoli, yet again, a year after we went back last year for the first time in over a decade. This time, though, it's not the city circuit. The Neapolitan press already calling it La Tappa più bella al mondo, the most beautiful stage in the world. Not like them to egg it up or sort of sing their own praises a little bit, but we'll be taking in Vesuvius, Pompeii, the Amalfi and Sorrento coasts, going through Amalfi itself, Positano. On the telly, it's going to look absolutely brilliant. The journey north then takes the riders into the Apennines. The first serious mountain test comes at Gran Sasso d'Italia, a mountain of Pantani and, more recently, Simon Yates fame. There was a little issue in the chairlifts as well, Daniel, if I remember last time as well. Our good mate Sean Kelly had a little bit of a coming together, let's say, with Mr. Venier at the end of that. That was an interesting afternoon trying to get down from there.
I'm glad you specified what that was, because the way you introduced it, it sounded much more scurrilous than it actually was.
It was chaotic. I remember sort of Simon Yates being escorted through with chaperones and everything. Anyway, after that, we go to the final stage of the opening block. That's a flat 33-kilometer time trial. For purists, we think it is pan flat and it finishes in Cesena. After a Romagnolo rest day, the Giro then returns to Tuscany with a stage finish by the Tyrrhenian Sea in Viareggio.
And that takes us, as we said, to stage 10, Rob, just beyond the first rest day. Just a couple of bits of historical or geographical trivia. You mentioned the stage to Lago Lacino. I noticed that after 60 kilometres that day, they go through a place called San Fele, which is where Fabian Cancellara's dad was born. Stage 6, the Napoli stage, they go over the Valico di Chiunzi, where Marco Pantani came a cropper, much like Matt White in the 2004 Tour de France, but he crashed into, I think it was a black cat. Or I'm not sure if whether the Giro mythology has embroidered some of the details there, black cats being unlucky in Italy, but lucky in our part of the world, aren't they, Rob? If you cross a black cat crosses your path, that's considered good luck, isn't it?
It's bad luck.
The opposite in Italy. I think it's good luck. But there's a lot of that, isn't there? Like, in Italy, they sort of invert all of our superstitions.
Spain as well. We have Martes 13 instead of Viernes 13. So Tuesday the 13th.
There you go. Matt, just first impressions of those first 10 days in particular.
Not a lot for the pure sprinters. Looking at that first 10 days, stage 2 is the only guaranteed sprint for me. 3, 5, and 6 could turn into sprints. 3, obviously there's a climb late in the stage that could dislodge the pure sprinters. And then 5 and 6, it'll all depends on the size of the break, the composition of the break. If they can be reeled back in, but that's not a lot for sprinters in the first 10 days of the Giro d'Italia.
It's funny actually, because organisers in their official press release said that there were 8 sprint stages, and I was like, you're looking around, where are these 8 stages? It's going to be interesting to see if they occur and how they top them up.
Yeah, the 8 stages. I was thinking if everything went right, there could possibly be 7. That's everything. If every break was caught, there's 7. I don't know where the 8th one is. I missed something there, but there won't be.
Doesn't look like it.
No.
I mean, Charles, we start with that 18.9-kilometre time trial. Obviously, a great opportunity for Filippo Ganna. I mean, there's been a lot of talk, obviously, about Remco Evenepoel and Giro needing Remco Evenepoel because it needs a star name, because the general consensus is it hasn't had that. It hasn't had the same kind of razzmatazz, crash-bang wallop as the other Grand Tours over the last few years. And, you know, one thing Italians always say, is that if you get an Italian in the first pink jersey, it sort of gives the home crowds a lift and increases their interest levels throughout the Giro. So the genuine hope that Ganna will take the first pink jersey. Whitey, one thing I've noticed, and I wanted to mention to you about this Giro in general, and also it also links to entertainment levels. Now, didn't really say at the time, but this year's race, I know the riders don't care and the teams don't care, but from a spectator's point of view, it wasn't the greatest Giro this year. And one reason I thought for that was that the starts on a lot of stages were relatively straightforward, and you didn't have situations where groups were going away, strong riders were going away, as the French say, à la pédale, i.e. on climbs earlier in the stages. And consequently, you know, you did get the kind of stereotypical TV break and a fairly innocuous break going away early. The starts in this Giro d'Italia, I think, are quite difficult throughout. And I don't know how you think that will affect the race.
Oh, well, it always makes it more challenging, that's for sure, and much harder to control. I think that's what I first noticed in the first week. Some of those first hour of racing is quite solid, which does leave a good platform for breaks to launch. But I think looking at the back end of the race, we haven't got onto that yet, but I think there's not too much in that first hour to put a cat amongst the pigeons there. So I think it will be a bit of the same as far as breakaways, but I'll be very curious to see who is on the start line. And I think a lot will depend for some guys on what we see in a week's time when the Tour de France is announced. Because someone like you said, Philippe Ogana, I think he would love to come and dominate the Giro. There's two time trials that are right down his alley. But let's see what that's the rumor is it that there's the TT's first day in the Tour de France that I've heard in the Basque region, which probably won't suit Ghana as much as he would have liked. So we'll know in the next few weeks. And I know all eyes and ears for teams are focused now on the Tour after we've seen the Vuelta. And then we'll be putting the pieces of our yearly puzzle together over the next couple of weeks.
Well, as you're just looking at a couple of those summit finishes as well, you will know them already. Lago Lacino, you should have done, I think, in 1998, which was your first Giro d'Italia. I don't know if you remember it. Alex Zullo won the stage and took the pink jersey, if I'm not mistaken, that day. And as Rob said, Campo Imperatore will hold fond memories for Simon Yates.
No, I only have flashbacks of the 1998 Giro. But I do remember Simon's stage win on Gran Sasso a couple of years ago. It was a day before the rest day, and we went into that rest day with first and second on general classification with Simon and Esteban, and exited with one. A lot was happening through that part of the Giro, but it was obviously a very bittersweet Giro for us, obviously winning five stages but then losing the jersey 48 hours from the finish.
And that's the first of several, I think, seven climbs in total that go over 2,000 metres of climbing in the Giro. And I suppose if the Giro has had an identity and it's tried to lean into an identity as well as, you know, this tagline of being the hardest race in the most beautiful place over the last few years, it's been longer climbs, higher climbs, and Gran Sasso, it's not the steepest, but it's 45, I think it's 40 or it's close to 45 kilometres, certainly over 40 kilometres, depending on where you take the bottom of the climb. And that's also going to be a feature this year. Those 2,000 meter climbs, Whitey.
Yeah, for people at home, it is true. The Giro is, you know, there is no climbs in the Vuelta at that length that they use or the Tour. So the times you go above 2,000 meters, the meters of climbing is multiplied a hell of a lot at the Giro, and it does make the race more. And not it's different. This is different. Let's put it that way. Because, you know, obviously in May, you are susceptible to a lot more varied weather conditions. So all those things do make the Giro. For me, I agree. It is the toughest of the three Grand Tours as far as physically. The Tour de France makes parts of it make it a lot more stressful, a lot tougher in other ways. And then the Vuelta as well. It's raced very different to the other two as well. So they all have their qualities, they all have their difficulties, but I do agree that the Giro is the toughest terrain-wise, and a big part of that is the amount of meters of climbing that you do.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Mornings can start feeling the same. Wake up, brush teeth, go to work. But with breakfast from Wendy's, it's like, wake up, brush teeth, baconate with a breakfast baconator, roll with the sausage breakfast burrito, buddy it up with a honey buddy, or get seasoned with seasoned potatoes, and then go to work. Sorry. When you're ready for a fresh wake-up call, gotta be Wendy's.
At participating US Wendy's during breakfast hours.
So, chaps, we have reached... Well, where have we reached? We've reached...
Viareggio.
Viareggio. We're past the first rest day. It's the 17th of May, Wednesday, 17th of May. We start in Camaiore, a destination well-known in, well, Tuscan cycling. Rob Hatch, where do we go next?
We then go to Tortona next. And we're going to celebrate, I think, the 70th anniversary of the fifth Giro won by the late, great Fausto Coppi, and also the centenary of his brother Cerce's birth. At least that's what I saw rumoured before the route was announced, and it has been announced that we're going to Tortona, home of the Coppis. After that, the race goes to Rivoli, further north into Piemonte, and then we go through Val d'Aosta and into Switzerland. to Crans Montana, 208 kilometers, long day, and the Cimacopi, which is going to be the Colle del Gran San Bernardo, the Col du Grand San Bernard. You've seen it in different races in the past. This is 2,400 meters high, so we've got to be hoping that the snow has disappeared and cleared off long before then. The day after, we come back to Italy from Sierre, going over another big high mountain pass, the Simplon Pass or the Passo Sempione. Then we've got a sort of Giro di Lombardia day, don't we? We go to Bergamo, 191 kilometres over the climbs like Miragolo San Salvatore, the Selvino, where we've seen issues on descents in the past in both the Giro and in the Giro di Lombardia. Then into the Città dei Mille, of course, the great city that we've seen the Giro di Lombardia start and finish in the last few years. Then, stage 16, after the second rest day, is to Monte Bondone. A big name from the past returns to the Giro d'Italia. But on first look, Daniel, I don't think it's the same side that Ivan Basso showed off his wares in 2006.
Yeah, never been up this side. The Giro's never been up this side. It's been at the Bondone in 1956. Charlie Gore famously won on that day in 1957, 1978. Panizza won 92, Furlan, and then 2006, Ivan Basso, but never from the Aldeno side. So that will be interesting. Long, tough climb, isn't it?
A very, very long climb, and preceded by a couple of other climbs as well towards the beginning. So a big mountain stage, that one, back after a 17-year absence, 19-year absence, pardon me, for doing my sums right. Then we go to Caorle, which is the sort of typical stage at this point in the race, isn't it? On the Venetian plain for the sprinters, that isn't always a sprint, as we saw a few years ago. Mr. Cima, who's no longer a pro cyclist, will remind us that. I think he's now one of the moto regulators in the Giro d'Italia, or he was at last look. Then over to the Val di Zoldo, and a big mountain stage. It's the sort of primo for the secondo the day after, isn't it? Because the secondo is the Tappone Dolomitico, 182 kilometres to Tre Cime di Lavaredo. Passo Campolongo, Valparola, Giao, Tre Cime. Hopefully this time no snow. There's certainly no Nibali. We'll see what happens in 2023 before a mountain time trial. To finish things off realistically, because we've still got one stage to ride, but more about that in a minute. I think this is probably what's going to dominate a lot of the discussion as well, what's coming up after this. But we go right to the border, don't we? Not just the border with Italy and Slovenia, but also with Austria. Three countries meet at the top of this mountain. It's Monte Lussari, 18.6 kilometer time trial uphill. I think, is it the first 11 kilometers of pan flat, something like that? And then we go straight uphill, ridiculous gradients in the Julian Alps, and it promises to be a big show. 1,200 meters of climb. That would be a lot, wouldn't it? 1,200 meters of climbing. The last sort of 10 kilometers, I think, around 8% average. Before the most controversial moment of this Giro d'Italia, a transfer on an aeroplane down to Roma, where the Giro's not always been received fantastically well. We'll have to see what happens, whether they find a better route with the roads this time. And that is the, 106th Giro d'Italia.
Well, a lot to sink our fangs into there, Matt, isn't there? A lot of really interesting climbs. I mean, starting from that sort of tour of swanky Swiss ski resorts on stage 13, we go to Verbier and then Crans Montana. I had a message, actually. Matt, what you'll remember, Alain Rumpf, who used to work for the UCI, he lives at the bottom, pretty much the bottom of the climb to Verbier. He said when the first rumours came out, I was afraid it'd be a long procession over the Grand San Bernard. Instead, the race is going over the Col de Croix de Coeur, an interesting, very Giro-esque choice. Really interesting descent. He says barely paved the descent at the moment. Not sure whether they'll improve it or not. And by all accounts, a really interesting climb and a bit of a crackerjack day. And then, as Rob said, those couple of days in the Dolomites, the Val di Zoldo, the classic stage to Tre Cime di Lavaredo, and then those obscene gradients on the stage on the time trial to Monte Lussari. First impressions again, Matt, of this second half of the race.
Not too much more for the sprinters. they're in for a rough one.
Does that give us an idea of what you're thinking of next year, anyway?
Well, they're in for a rough one. Yeah, Dylan Groenewegen will not be going. I can guarantee you that. Now, look, it is, I think, the 2 days into Switzerland. That's tough at the back end of the race. Maybe not the GC days, but they are tough days. Again, 15, 16, not easy, especially 16. That's a brutal second half of the stage, or two-thirds of the stage. 18 and 19, no surprise. Two very, very tough days bookended. And for me, the time trial looks very interesting because I would think that would definitely involve a bike change. I think that climb, the gradients up to the finish line are too steep and long enough to justify a bike change. So that's always that always causes a lot of stress for mechanics and riders alike. But it's entertaining, and that's not an easy time trial. And someone with good legs or someone with bad legs are going to get caught out or make big advantages so close to the finish.
Well, Rob and I were talking about this the other day, Matt, and there are obvious parallels there with the Planche des Belles stage in the Tour de France in 2020. Similar sort of configuration, a flat start and then a tough climb. And, you know, you mentioned the bike change, but also that day, and I think with hindsight, I think Primoz Roglic has admitted it, the warm-up or lack of warm-up or the fact that he did do a warm-up and maybe went too hard, you know, all these things to kind of conjure with. And maybe, you know, even logistically, it might be difficult. If someone was minded to do a recon, probably won't in the morning. It's probably too difficult, isn't it? But, you know, even getting back to the start, these things have to be considered, I suppose.
They do. Looking at this route in general, so I wouldn't be surprised to see Primoz on the start line of the Giro next year. I think it's a course that suits him. And I think now with Vingegaard as the clear leader there at Jumbo-Visma, I would think in his final years there, he would be looking to try to win a Grand Tour. And I think the Giro 2023 presents a very favorable route that favors him a lot. And then that time trial, well, the other two time trials favor him, but that's a tough one. That's a tough one. But, you know, guys, you saw in that Planche des Belles TT, he was, you know, lights were out. Yeah, he rode a very good time trial, I think fourth or fifth on the stage. But, you know, it's one of those ones there. It's the fatigue. That's harder than a hilltop finish racing against someone else because you're on your own. And it's a very tough way to finish a Grand Tour.
Matt, I was going to, at the start of this part, ask you about your first Giro d'Italia because we did mention Lago Lacena. I completely forgot to do it. But since we're at the end of the 2023 Giro d'Italia in our presentation, or we're heading towards Rome, and there's a link with your first Giro d'Italia because in 1998 you were riding for a team, Amore Vita, who was effectively a team sponsored by the Vatican.
And Mr. Berlusconi.
And Mr. Berlusconi.
What a combination.
Secondary sponsor. Forza Arcore, which eventually
what
became Forza Italia.
It was an anti-abortion Forza Italia with the Vatican blessed by the on the step. Our team photo was we were on. I have it as a proud place in my parents' house. I grew up with 12 years of Catholic schooling, and there's a photo of me with the Pope. As soon as you walk into my mum and dad's house, there's a picture of me with the Pope, Pope John Paul II, and in our AC Milan stripes, red and black, because that was a team that also Berlusconi owned. So the strip was red and black because of him, with big Forza Italia across, and then 25 other minor sponsors. We were a walking billboard, and also that Giro that was started in Nice. Prologue in Nice, and that was the last Grand Tour that did not have a rest day.
Wow.
Not a single rest day. Then because it just didn't work for the organisers at the time, they just thought we'll just keep the ball rolling. And the UCI then made it mandatory after that. Firstly, mandatory to have a rest day, which was pretty common. But then within a couple of years, that was the introduction after that of, I can't exactly remember when two rest days were introduced and have stuck ever since.
So, Matt, just take us back, rewind a little bit. How did that happen? How did you come to be riding for a team? You weren't the first non-Italian to ride for that team. Amore Vita is a kind of institution, a sort of motley institution that had been around for a long time, run by the Fanini family in Tuscany. But how did that occur?
Yeah, so I was riding for ZVVZ. Giant the year before, which was a combination of our... So in 1996, that was when amateur and professional cycling finished. So 1997, there was elite cycling and then under 23. Well, 96 was elite cycling and under 23. So the possibility for teams to enter different races changed then. And so our national team turned into a semi-professional team in 1997, 96 and 97. And then at the end of that year, the team was going to merge with an American team, Saturn, which was the biggest team in the States for 1998. And the deal fell over very, very late. Very, very late. I'm talking November, December. I remember being back in Australia getting prepared for the next season. And so I was left without a team going into 1998. Now, Shane Bannon, who was the high performance director at Cycling Australia at the time, had ridden for Fanini as an amateur, and he had connections with him. And he managed to get myself and Peter Rogers into the team. And that was funded, our salary was funded by the Australian Institute of Sport, because that was, you know, we still had scholarships at the time. So we went in there. That was our connection getting into Italy. I never raced a day in Italy as an amateur. I did all my racing, Belgium, Holland, Germany, France. So my first ever race as a professional was in Italy. I guess was as a professional. So it was a interesting team, to say the least. And the two previous years they had won stages with Danish riders, Nicolo Bye Larsen, one Dane and Glenn Magnussen. In the 98 era, we won another stage with Glenn as well. So that was fond memories of that era. But I did. It was a tough one, and I remember I got eliminated on the Thursday or the Friday with a group of 60 odd riders. Including the points winner, help me out here. Road for Quickstep. Road Finney was with ASICS at the time. Tuscan rider who now coaches. Michele Bartoli. We were in a group of 60 riders. It was a stage. I can't remember that Pantani. What?
He'd had the pink jersey earlier in the race.
Also, his teammate took it on the stage up to on the stage up to San Marino. And that was ASICS. Yeah. So we were in a group of 60 riders and we missed the time cut by 1 minute 10 or 1 minute 15. And because the commissaire at that race had enforced time cuts earlier in the race, really cutthroat, I remember one stage a guy had crashed and missed the time cut and they went boom, home. So we had to follow suit. So 60 of us missed the time cut, 50 to 60, and including five of my teammates. So I think they started. That was when we had teams of nine. So I think they limped to the finish in the last 48 hours with a group of three. But it was a tough old Giro, that's for sure. And my first experience doing races over a week.
That team, anti-abortion, anti-smoking, anti-doping. In 2001, I think after the 9/11, they rode for the rest of the season with some kind of stars and stripes jersey to commemorate the victims of the 9/11 terrorist attacks. And very unusual team. We mentioned, Matt, the race is going to Rome on the final day. A lot of teeth gnashing. A lot of us are pretty unimpressed with that, unhappy for various reasons. Some of them selfish, some of them with an eye certainly towards, well, the environmental implications. And what do you think as a team manager, particularly, you're going to be in the thick of the logistical planning to get everyone, mechanics, vehicles, those, or take them on that 740-kilometre journey from up in the far northeast to Rome?
It's tricky. It's nothing that the Tour de France doesn't do a lot of the time. But we'll probably end up going there with a skeleton staff, a skeleton crew, and our service course is in the Varese area. So a lot of our trucks and vehicles will just go home directly from the Saturday stage, and we'll probably end up with a couple of vehicles and a race car. And then we may even take a different crew. They drive down from Varese down to Rome and everyone goes home except for the directors and a couple of key staff, because it's a big transfer. Oh, I'm sure the stage will start late on the Sunday afternoon in Rome. But, the last time we finished in Rome, I think, was in when in 18th, and that was a pretty average circuit. So, which they ended up having,
so average that it didn't happen in the end.
Well, they ended up calling the time. It was so rough that the time stopped, yeah. And about 25 people raced. I think the last little bit, and even. I remember taking, it was 2009 Giro, when I had Bradley Wiggins in the team at Garmin, and he got robbed the time trial win on the last stage because he ended up the last 4 or 5 kilometres he had to do in torrential rain and in the yeah. city of Rome, and there was cobbles, and we came around the corner.
And then Menchov crashed.
And we came around the corner, and there was a rider in a car sprayed across the middle of the road. He had to go around that, and I think actually... My local from Lever, Ignatis Kozanovalovas, won the stage, who lives 500 or 600 meters up the road from me here in Lever. He won the stage from Cervelo, and Brad just missed out by 10 to 15 seconds. I think he lost the time trial by. But that were the two times that certainly stuck in my memory, finishing off in Rome. But it'll be a tough old end to what is always a beautiful race.
Selfish point of view, they're two of the best office views I think I've ever had commentating on site, the finish line, the Colosseum in 2009, and then looking across at all the beautiful sort of cypress trees and the old ruins of ancient Rome in 2018. But as Daniel was saying then, you just want to go home, don't you, that night before.
A lot of people...
You don't want to be in a car for 6, 7 hours.
A lot of people would have been a lot happier with a finish in Trieste, maybe. To get on 9 o'clock flights, but so be it. It is. It will be. Rome is a beautiful city, and fitting into what is always a spectacular race.
Yeah, I mean, I've how many years has it been now? It's going to be my fifth year on the bounce. I put a lot into this race. I put a lot of been a lot of sacrifices, a lot of hard work. I've had a lot of rewards too from the race, and. But I just think it's time to move on, regardless of how it goes, and just try something new, or not new, just something, you know, you go to the Tour or something. But it's not just about the Grand Tours for me. I think, like, I miss doing Tour of the Basque Country and these races that I can't do because I'm preparing for the Giro. Like, they're some of my sort of favorite races that I really enjoy. And the last 5 years, I've missed these sort of races. So it's just a bit of that. Bit of that, really. I mean, you never know what happens in the future, and I could be saying all this jazz, and then next year I'm back again, but that's just my general feeling at the moment.
Well, chaps, we heard there from Matt, one of your star riders, Simon Yates, talking to me before the start of the 2022 Giro d'Italia, saying that the 2022 race would probably be his last for a while, certainly as the main focus of his season. As we know, he wanted to do well in that race, maybe finish on the podium, perhaps even win it, and didn't go the way he wanted, and he had to pull out through injury. Wisey, should we take that, what Simon said, before the 2022 race, at face value, given what we've learned over the last few days about how the 2023 Giro is going to look?
I think the most important thing that Simon said hasn't changed. I think he's looking for something different. I think five years in a row, it's a big focus. And for him also, he's a racer. He enjoys racing. And when you do focus on the Giro, like he stated in that little clip there, that does take him out of a lot of the races that he loves to do. And
I noticed, Matt, just looking a couple of weeks ago, I was looking at his results, and he's hardly ridden any monuments in the last 5 years. He's ridden 2 or 3. I mean, I know he was talking there about 1 week stage races primarily, but he hasn't done a lot of kind of Lombardies, Lieges.
Yeah, and the strange thing is they're not, for him, they don't personally motivate him that much, which everyone has their focus, and everyone has their races that they dream of winning. And for him, you know, a Liège and Lombardy are two races where he could definitely has the ability to win those races, but they're not races high up on his priority list. He enjoys racing to win, and stage races are his thing. So I wouldn't be surprised to see him back at doing some of the races that he did speak about in that clip.
So what happens now? You wait until, well, you certainly got to wait until the Tour route is released. Then do you wait even until the Vuelta route is unveiled before you really sort of open the spreadsheets and start planning certainly his season, or will it be, will that be enough information after next week to start thinking about what Major Tour might be his main focus?
No, I think, well, the spreadsheets have been open a long time. They were opened, well, I usually try to do them before the Tour de France, just because when you're going on, when you're hiring or rehiring riders, you're trying to put that puzzle together. You know roughly what the Giro is going to look like, the Tour is going to look like, all the other races. So you got to look at where your weaknesses are, where you need to improve. And I think, you know, the Tour, it might have an effect on the last one or two riders who we end up taking, about the versatile riders, or where, you know, if there's seven sprint stages or four or whatever that may be, where those last spots. But at the end of the day, your key riders, you know, once you've made your mind up or discussed with those riders and your stakeholders where you're going to go, I think the course doesn't change too much. And as far as the Vuelta, you know, usually it's a race there that will have a certain amount of guys targeting, but then we'll leave that there as the wild card there, that if something goes wrong with someone from the Giro or the Tour, that they've always got the Vuelta up their sleeve. And the other thing that changes next season as well is we're going back a bit old school there with the position of the World Championships prior to the Vuelta, how it used to be, which changes some things for some riders. The guys who are targeting the Worlds, their race program will look a little bit different. They'll probably try to have to hang on to form post-Tour de France instead of having that dip and coming back up again. So, yeah, there's a lot of things to consider. But, yeah, next week will be really interesting because, obviously, for every team, the Tour de France is the big one that they want to get right, in whatever right it means for that team, whether it's GC, a stage win, or something else.
I mean, chaps, there's the broader question of who is going to go to the Giro d'Italia. And I don't know about you, Rob, but watching the presentation the other day, it struck me that more than ever, RCS are kind of leaning into the Giro, perhaps because of the absence of big Italian hopes, big Italian stars. They're really leaning into sort of using the Giro as a showcase for Italy. And, you know, the moving, well, we heard that they were going to finish the race in Trieste, and then at the last minute they made an agreement with Rome. That was also to do with showing off Italy, selling Italy. And, you know, there is a lot of sort of teeth gnashing in Italian cycling about the Giro, whether it's going to be able to attract the big names. There's been talk of these 70 kilometres of time trialing. Is that a move to try and court Remco Evenepoel? I'll just read you something that Italian journalist Cristiano Gatti wrote earlier this week when the route was announced. The most prestigious of routes loses its aura if we don't have a worthy cast of champions, if the orchestra's not worthy of the music. At the moment, regarding this, is a question mark as high as the Tre Cime di Lavaredo. We certainly won't have Pogacar and Vingegaard, i.e. the upper crust of Grand Tour riders, but the ladies and gentlemen behind the Giro are going to have to come up with someone, even if it means frog marching them to Italy. I mean, he also pointed out that in 2024, we think that the Giro is going to start in Florence, and there are going to be three stages in Italy. We think there's a good chance of that. And Cristiano Gatti was pointing out that the comparison might not be very flattering if the Tour does go to Italy in 2024. But yeah, that is a question that's hanging over the Giro. How is it going to attract names that are going to get pulses racing?
Well, they're trying, aren't they? They're trying their best in terms of the route. I mean, it was obvious that it's been laid on to try and bring Evenepoel here, even to try and get Pogacar here, although I'm pretty sure that was unrealistic. You know, they put the time trial right on the Slovenian border. They've given him a lot of climbing. They've given him a lot of time trial kilometres. I'm not sure there's anything more they can do, really, in terms of trying to attract people with
money.
Well, there is that, isn't there? But I wasn't going to mention that.
It's
a great unsaid, isn't it? I don't know whether Matt White can elaborate on this, but I don't know why we feel so queasy about mentioning it. I mean, I think it's a pretty much an open secret that there are cash incentives that are offered to certain riders to do certain races, particularly the Giro. Matt, yeah, you're at liberty to say as much or as little as you want.
I think whatever the cash incentives are, I think team objectives and exposure and priorities will overrule that. And I think the teams and the sponsors and the partners and stakeholders are the ones who have a big influence there on where riders end up. And, you know, no one has gone back-to-back in the modern era of cycling winning the Giro and Tour, and I don't see that changing anytime soon. The one reason where you could get Pogacar back in would make a softer Giro. Maybe that would entice... You know, go old, really old school. Remember the year that Pataki won 9 stages or 8 stages. and I think Robbie McEwen still won 2. So, you know, that would be probably one way you could get some of the big stars to back up if it was a softer Giro. And because the thing that scares people from the Giro is just the amount of stress, and then having to back up 4 weeks later and do it all over again hasn't been repeated. Look, I think Chris Froome came close with a win and a podium in 2018, but in the last 25 years since Pantani in 98, there has been no one been able to back up in the two.
I mean, it's a difficult balancing act as well for RCS Sport, because they've obviously tried to globalise the event and globalise its appeal over the last 10, 15 years.
But which they've done a very good job too.
It culminates next year. I mean, I'll be commentating the race for Discovery, Eurosport, GCN, whichever platform you want on. And next year, I think we've got the biggest geographical area of rights that we've ever had. We're even live in New Zealand, which is a territory that's evaded a lot of, you know, we've always tried to buy the rights there as a company. I say we, I'm freelancer working for that company. They're selling as much and as many hours. And I think next year as well, it's going to be every single pedal stroke as well, sort of start to finish. So,
wow.
The Giro is on a par with the Tour in that sense, and it's going to get a lot of progress. And you can see, you talked about the presentation, Daniel, you know, how they were talking about selling Italy, showing off Italy. You know, it's something that they always do. And you've talked at length on Giro podcasts about this, about the Italians wanting to be loved, wanting their country to be loved, wanting to show it off and wanting to be recognised as the più bello al mondo and all that sort of stuff. And this is just the sort of culmination of it. But again, it's difficult to see where else they can go in terms of trying to sell it, really, than doing what they're doing. I'm sort of torn by this as a fan, because I love the Giro as the purest Grand Tour. In that sense, I don't want it to change. I want it to be Italian. I don't want it to be globalised. But obviously, to make money and continue to exist, they have to move with the times.
Yeah. I mean, and everything has moved with the times. You know, Matt, we were talking earlier about your first Giro in 1998. If you go back and look at the start list for that race, probably 16 of the 20 teams were Italian. And, you know, I was looking at poor old, you know, poor Jai Hindley and Arno Demar, and I can't remember who else they got onto the stage the other day, who were, you know, ostensibly they were the stars of the 2022 race, but they don't speak Italian. And, you know, probably in the 90s, the Ivan Gottis, the Paolo Savoldellis were no more personalities than Jai Hindley is now. However, because they were speaking a common language with the press, and because, you know, it was easy to build those little rivalries, you know, so-and-so said something which could be construed in a certain way. The next day in La Gazzetta, there were two stages saying that Gotti had attacked Savoldelli, he'd insulted him, and so on and so forth. And because it was parochial, it was easy to create those storylines, which are very difficult to create now and to reproduce.
Definitely, definitely. But I think where the Giro and the Vuelta were pre-World Tour, they were turning into very much, you know, the Vuelta and there was vastly dominated by local teams. But the coverage and the awareness of those races in the global market was much smaller. So I think the World Tour has globalized our sport very successfully, and those two races have probably benefited the most. That, you know, no one knew anything about the Vuelta outside of hardcore cycling fans. Not too many people would have heard about the Giro or the Vuelta. And I think over the last 15 years, the awareness of those two races has been on the up and up. And I think the Giro has done a very good job of promoting their race. And they're always, like I said, they're always going to struggle to get the big stars, you know, 4 weeks out from the Tour de France, but they've done a great job, and I think they can continue to with the route they put in front of us for next year.
Matt, while we've got you here, just before we finish, we're going to look forward a little bit to 2023 generally. I mean, you mentioned a few minutes ago just that process of planning, the recruitment, the kind of puzzle, all the puzzle pieces have to be fitted together. When you and like Brent Copeland and your other direct sportifs sort of started thinking about 2023 a couple of months ago, what were the areas that you thought needed addressing? I mean, I'm talking here about the men's team mainly. I don't know how involved you are in recruitment with the women's team. I mean, just to recap, I mean, the team had a very successful season. I think it was probably overshadowed by a lot of that talk about relegation or not relegation. But you actually, you know, you had 22 wins in total, and that was 13 more than the previous year, I think.
Yeah. No, we were off the bounce off our worst year ever. But, 22 wins, and I think 8 or 9 World Tour wins. Not too many teams won a stage in all 3 Grand Tours. Yet we're still fighting for relegation. Just shows how ridiculous the point system is. But no, it was, what were we looking for? Well, first one was to lock in our key riders. So, you know, as an organisation going forward, we have Simon Yates for 2 more years. We have Michael Matthews for 3 more years. We have Dylan Groenewegen for another 2. So we've got our winners locked in. And what we could do with the backing of our sponsors, now we know we have at least a 3-year sponsorship deal in front of us. So it was a good time for us to go a bit younger, refresh the team a little bit and look for some young talent. And we had always done our best when we have time to develop that talent as well. So, you know, it's a professional sport. It's a cutthroat industry, and you have to keep winning. But when you have a little bit of time, when, you know, the business model of cycling, when we are 100% reliant on our sponsors, you have to keep winning all the time in the biggest paces and the biggest races. And now we have time to develop those young guys over the next 3 years and look for where our next wave of stars and champions are coming from.
And just looking at some of the names that are coming in, Eddie Dunbar, Zdenek Stibar, Zana, the Italian national champion, Chris Harper, who was very impressive towards the end of the season for Jumbo-Visma, Lucas Pustelberger, and then you've got to cover a few neo-pros. Wallet Bearer, is it?
Hargos is his first name. Another Ethiopian, little rough diamond we've got on our hands there. So we have got some young talent coming into the team, a couple of young Australians, the European champion from Germany.
Blake Quick. Is he quick by nature?
He is. He's our national road champion under 23 and national criterium champion. And we've got 5 neo pros next year and 8 or 9 new riders. So that's a big turnover for us. But it was, you know, after what had happened over the last couple of years with the Manuela Foundation attempted buyout and COVID and everything else, we needed a refreshing, and 2023 is a continuation of that rejuvenation of the squad.
How do you see Dunbar fitting in? What's he going to bring?
What he was missing at Ineos was opportunity. Now, there's a guy who won 2 stage races this year, and I think he's only done 1 Grand Tour in the 4 or 5 years that he actually did with Ineos. So he was preparing for he'd won 2 races in the spring and still couldn't make the Giro roster. So we got him pretty. We saw that's a good place for teams like us to look. Is look at those big teams with a lot of money and look at guys who aren't getting the opportunities that they want. And someone like Eddie will walk into this team as a leader. And we haven't locked in our programs next year, but I wouldn't be surprised if you see someone like Eddie Dunbar leading us at the Giro d'Italia next year. You know, whereas he couldn't even make the team at Ineos in 2022. So for us, he's going to give us another backup for Simon Yates. When we've got Simon racing, for example, if it's Basque Country for general classification, we've got someone else racing on another front. So that's something we have lacked since Adam Yates left the team, where we were battling on 2 fronts very successfully. So I think Eddie's going to be a really good value add for us on the GC front, and he's excited to get those opportunities, which he will definitely get with us.
And just finally, Matt, I did promise you the opportunity to vent a little bit about an issue in professional cycling. We were talking about themes that might become hot topics in the coming year. You know, in the last couple of years, we've talked about the emergence of all these very young riders and how they've excelled. And I asked you whether there was something you wanted to talk about. And Rob Hatch, you can defend the case of television.
Oh, no, here we go.
Discussion in this short discussion. Matt, you were maligning to me yesterday the role that television motorbikes have been having on races in the last few months and potentially a few years. Just expand on that.
Yes. Okay. So I can say the easiest and the fairest way for me to say it is now we're not at a bike race. So I'm not pointing fingers at any certain result. But and like we discussed the other day, if you go back and look, especially in Italy, if you look at races, especially Milan-San Remo, on the Poggio, for example, motorbikes have always been part of our sport. Now, anyone who goes to the biggest races or a fan on the side of the road is probably a little bit gobsmacked with the amount of motorbikes around. Some are necessary and some are certainly not. I don't know why 20 different organisations needed the same photographer taking a photo in front of a breakaway. But scientifically, it is proven that draft does exist. and the UCI, in their wisdom, made a changing to the rule a week ago for time trials. That, you know, the rule for time trials is that a team car couldn't sit closer than 10 metres to the back of a bike rider. And now they've made it 15 metres. Now, that's great. But we also know that there is various vehicles in front of the rider and various vehicles behind the rider, like television motorbikes, who sit very close and also that who do have a direct impact on the race. Now, back in the day, a lot of the races weren't covered live start to finish. So yeah, there was motorbikes in the bike race. They did affect the race, but it was in certain times. Now the majority of our races are live now, and like Rob was saying, yeah, the Giro and the Tour and a lot of the world, it's live start to finish. So there are a lot of vehicles who are in front of the race. And I just think, and this does affect positively and negatively the brake and the bunch, but it does have a massive effect on drafting. You know, when you've got a television motorbike or a photographer on the back of a motorbike sitting under 10 metres in front of a group, that's 55, 60 kilometres an hour. That is a big drafting effect. Or a television motorbike directly filming a time trialer 3 metres behind them, which does happen. You're getting some nice close-up shots. Or a motorbike coming into the last kilometre and a bunch sprint with a motorbike filming a head-on shot. Now, that's a safety issue. So there's lots of things to discuss there, but I think the UCI, who should enforce the rules to make our races safe and fair, there could be some simple rules to put in place to make it a level playing field.
Rob, what have you got to say for yourself?
To be honest, I don't think there's anything I disagree with. That's the issue. Obviously, we want. I've been in a nasty position of having to commentate on those incidences where we've sadly seen people lose their lives. We've seen people have awful injuries, and you know, it's not a nice place to try and find the words to say something and accompany those images. It's pretty horrible. So that's the last thing we want. Obviously, safety has to be always the first thing in terms of bringing the images to you. Yeah, I mean, we've got technology surely to have better cameras with better zooms. I'm not sure. I'm not a camera operator, but I would imagine that do we always have to be that close? I'm not sure. I think part of the problem is maybe that there is so much coverage now, and people are obviously organisers trying to save money and things like that. You don't always get the best production team that follows, let's say, the Tour de France working on a third division race in Italy on a Wednesday afternoon. And it's not those camera operator faults, it's not those directors' faults, but maybe we should be thinking about getting a team of, you know, a couple of crack teams of top directors, top camera operators who know where they are, who also maybe know the riders as well. That could help. I'm not sure. Know the directors, know the riders. I mean, I saw an incident. I was commentating on Wednesday afternoon. I think it was the Giro del Veneto, either that or the Veneto Classic on Sunday. And Matteo Trentin was quite rightly getting pretty angry with one of the motorbikes because he was zooming down this descent. And again, I'm sure the motorbike pilot was doing his very best, but he was just too close. He was that close that he was in the way. And it wasn't even one of those situations where you're talking about people, you know, helping the brake or helping the peloton and things like that, creating a draft. It was simply a safety issue. But then again, let's not kid ourselves. This is a problem that's been around since Adam were a lad. Talk to our mate Sean Kelly and he'll tell you about certain helicopters being in certain places that prevented him winning certain big races because a certain nationality had to win that race. Giro di Lombardia. You know, all sorts of things going on. But I can't argue with your point that something needs to be done about that. And it is too close. Even us, we want to see nice close pictures because, you know, a lot of the time we're not at the races nowadays with all this, you know, certainly after COVID and things like that. We're watching on the same sort of size television screen as you are. You know, when I'm working in the home studio, I'm looking at a screen that's about the size of maybe twice a little YouTube video or something like that. So we want to see, you know, who's there to try and give you the best information, but not at the cost of you know, influencing the races or even compromising safety.
The directors will push their luck, won't they, Rob? I mean, in the same way that team directors will push their luck in the sense they'll tell a rider, maybe not, I'm not pointing any fingers at you, Matt, you would never do such a thing, but tell a rider, you know, just hold on to this bottle a little bit longer until you really get screamed at. And TV directors will tell a moto pilot, just stay in there until they, you know, they really get angry and you've got no other option but to...
Yeah.
but to follow their
orders. That's what Matt was saying there as well. It comes down to the UCI, doesn't it? Like everything. They have to be the proper arbiters, and they have to be, you know, you want a strong referee, Jeff. You want somebody who'd, you know, you want somebody who sets the rules and they're applied, simple as.
Yep. And the rules apply for us as teams. And I think that the people involved in the race should also, there should be certain rules that should be applied that they have to follow as well.
Well, chaps, I think that concludes today's entertainment. A very warm thank you for your time, Matt. You've been extremely generous with your time and extremely insightful as always. And next week, we're going to do a similar thing. We're going to be looking at the Tour de France presentation. So next week's podcast won't come out until after that happens. Things on Thursday. We'll have another couple of cracking guests for that. But in the meantime, I'm going to say thanks to you, Matt White, and I'm going to wish you a restful and very enjoyable winter, which will be spent mostly in Spain, I believe.
Yeah, up until Christmas, I'll be here, and then head back to Oz for Christmas to see my family, and then stay there for the month of January, where we're getting back our World Tour races back to Tour Down Under, and Cadel Evans Classic will be back on as World Tour events in 2023. Looking forward to it.
You'll be going back to, is it Cornula, where you we established Cronulla. That you're the second most famous sportsman after Steve Waugh's got a beachside Cronulla. Got a beachside
Cronulla.
Property there.
Cronulla. That's where mum and dad live,
Cronulla,
but I'll be back in Sydney enjoying myself over Christmas New Year break.
Nice.
And talking of nerdly medium pacers, Rob Hatch, you'll be staying in Mallorca for the foreseeable future.
Yes, going on holiday next week. Looking forward to that. First sort of 2 weeks putting everything down for quite a few years, actually. So I'm going back to my spiritual home in the Canary Islands for a couple of weeks. Can't wait.
Oh, nice.
Well, happy holidays to you. That is all. Thank you, Matt.
Cheers, gents.
And thank you, Rob.
Cheers.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.